The information and ideas provided within this show are intended for educational purposes only and not intended as investment advice. The hosts of this show do not provide tax or legal advice. You should consult with your tax or legal professional regarding your individual situation. No information should be interpreted as securities advice. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, and investment professionals. While we have endeavored to ensure the accuracy of the information in this program, we do not guarantee or give any warranty as to the accuracy, timeliness, or completeness of any information. The process of buying and selling a business can be frightening for the parties involved. What paperwork is needed? What is the true market value of the business? How do you know what transactions are required to be processed in addition to the sale of the business? Welcome to Biz Broker Talk, where you'll find the answers to these questions and much more. Your hosts, Robert Howells and Doug Scheiding, have a decade of experience providing business broker services to large and small businesses. Today, they're ready to help you. Here's Robert and Doug.
Welcome to Biz Broker Talk with Robert Howells and Doug Scheiding. Doug is on vacation this week. Last week, we discussed deferred sales trust, and this week, we were visiting with Warren Barhorst. Warren runs a business known as Essential. It is a risk management, insurance, and financial services business. I've known Warren, sad to say, over 30 years. Warren volunteers his time to Texas A&M and serves as past president and current vice president of the Jackie Sherrill 12th Man Kickoff Foundation, as well as a member of the university's Industrial Distribution Degree Industrial Advisory Board. He also serves as a mentor for University of Houston Wolf Center for Entrepreneurship. Warren's passion is for financial literacy and business success. Frequently has him presenting from coast to coast, from fourth grade classrooms to executive boardroom. Welcome, Warren.
I'm glad to be here, Robert. Thanks for having me.
This week, we're going to talk with Warren and discuss how to plan for success in small business, specifically cover important risk management principles and talk about ways small business owners can capture the wealth in their business. Why don't we start off by talking about the first segment? Let's talk about planning for success.
Well, you know, it's an interesting concept, and I think that one of the things in my life that I think is my secret to success is the ability to dream. And I wrote about this in my first book, and you know, people ask me, well, what's your secret to success? And I would tell them that I actually can kind of think about the future and walk towards that dream on a daily basis. And as my business has gotten bigger and bigger, I learned that, you know, you can't touch all your employees, because my number two secret to success is to teach your employees to dream. We actually have a dream manager that works in our company that can touch our employees on an individual day or a daily basis to work with them on achieving their dreams. And that dream might be inside of our firm, growing to a new position or whatever. It could be you're working on a part-time position here trying to get your college degree, and your dream is to be a nurse or something else.
That's unique.
Yeah, it's very, very unique, and it's actually helped us become very, very successful.
Well, very good. What are some of the other principles that you rely on?
Well, you know, what's interesting is we started a business consulting firm about 8 years ago with a friend of mine that retired from a large insurance company, and we just kind of connected and started working with small business owners, and most of that is spent with insurance agents, but we've done some work with the SBA and other people, and we started researching or polling things and looking at businesses, and we've discovered that about 5% of businesses have a plan.
5%?
5%.
Okay.
You know, and people go, that's crazy, Warren, or whatever. But I also would tell you that 98% of businesses have less than $1 million a year in sales.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
There's a Fortune 100 and a Fortune 500. then there's 5,000, you know, fast-growing companies on the Inc. 5,000. But there's not a whole lot of really big, really big companies. Most of them are small businesses, you know, in your business trying to help people buy and sell those companies. But so 5% of them have a plan. We've also learned that about 5% of the population writes down their own dreams and goals. And, you know, I ask people all the time, you know, would you drive to Montana without a map?
No.
And the answer is no. You won't even go to find a Starbucks without consulting the almighty Google to get you there. But people try to run their business every day. So we also know statistically in our financial services business that about 5% of the population retires financially independent. And I'm not a rocket scientist. I barely graduated from college. I crammed 4 years into five. and, So I would tell you that I did learn one thing, that if you write down your dreams and goals, if you plan your business where you want it to go, you can become financially independent. You won't depend on your friends and family or the government to reach your retirement plan. So that's the first thing I would tell you that people need to do in business, is to set out, you know, and I always tell them to begin with the end in mind, you know, and look at, set your end game vision, decide what it is, where you want to be in 5 years, where you want to be in 10 years, and then work backwards to find the parts and pieces that make you get to that point. So,
well, let's talk a little bit more. If you've discovered this, how have you implemented it for yourself?
So we're bottom-up planners in our organization. So we just finished our kickoff meeting for 2014. We had all of our associates in, most of our vendor partners come to that meeting and participate in it. But we go to our agents that are out in the field, and we actually ask them, what are you going to do this year? Instead of me deciding at the top that we're going to sell X amount and then I divvy that out to each producer, I ask the producer, what do you think you can do this year? We take that number and we roll that forward and roll it all together, aggregate the total. Then we share that number with the group as our combined goal. And then each person has actually set their own individual goal. And you got a much higher chance of success, because that's your goal, Robert, not a goal that Warren gave you.
Well, don't let big corporations find out about this. That would blow their whole idea about how to run a corporation, then, right?
Bottom-down planning is the way they do it, because they're trying to decide. But if you don't, in my opinion, if you don't get feedback from your employees, you're setting yourself up to fail. If you don't have that field intelligence, if you've not talked to your sergeants and privates that are out in the field, there's no way you can be successful. And that's, you know, if you're a plumber, listen to this show, whatever business you're in, if you talk to your people that are talking to your customers, they'll give you a real good idea what's going on in your business.
Very good. I also failed to mention that you're also an author. I understand about to come out your second book, but your original book is Game Plan, the Definitive Playbook for Starting and Growing Your Business. You wrote that about 4 years ago?
Yeah, it came out in 2008. It's our attempt to try to make it simple for people to learn about how to start or to take their existing business and grow it. You know, I'll make the offer today. If people want to send an email in, we'll give away 2 or 3, 4 books this afternoon, and let people have a free book if they want one.
Very good, very good.
But you know, the cool thing about the book was it was our way to share what the simple tricks or techniques that we use to make our business successful. We understand that most of society actually comprehends on about an 8th grade reading level. So the book was written in a unique way. Basically,
it was written for me.
It was written for you, Robert. It was, you know, we basically dictated. People would ask me questions. Rusty Burson's the guy who helped me write it. We would have a conversation, tape record it, translate those conversations into text, so it really sounds like me talking to you, and it's very fast to read. You can read it in 2 to 2.5 hours and have a pretty good idea of what you need to do to start your business or to grow your existing business.
Very good. Well, in the planning segment that we're in right now, how have you coached other businesses? I mean, with your speaking engagements and such, and your consultancy, what have, give us some examples.
You know, it's really, really interesting, because we've learned that very few people actually have a plan, and then very few people actually have any financial data on their company. And I've met with a very successful business owner in New York City, and I asked him, well, you know, what kind of profit are you making? You know, what kind of money do you think you make? He said, well, I won't know this year until I close my accounts. And I said, what do you mean, close your accounts? And he said, well, at the end of the year, we pay all the bills and we close checking account out. Whatever's left in the checking account, that's how much money we determine we have as profit.
Simple enough. Most businesses run that way. Correct.
That is correct. And you know what I would tell you, and we'll talk about it later in the show about how to maximize your wealth or get the wealth out of your business. It won't work if you're trying to sell a business or buy one.
None.
It doesn't yeah. work that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, we probably talk to about, in my office, we probably talk between, I don't know, 5 and 10 business owners a week, and there's only one or two that we are even conceive of listing because of the financial aspect of it. But most people manage their business via checkbook, which is really cash flow management, And that's what makes simple to them. They understand it. But like you stated before, is it's financial literacy issues. They just don't understand financials.
And that what by not tracking it or not measuring it, you can't manage it. So if and it's not that difficult in today's world to track it because QuickBooks is so easy to use. There's all kinds of accounting softwares that are out there. If you just enter those entries into that ledger, then at the end of the year, or we would urge you to do it more frequently than that. You can run the numbers and see where you're spending your money at and if you're making any money.
And how it compares to prior periods.
Yeah.
Because that's true. When we go to list a business, we're asking for at least the last 3 years tax returns. Well, I haven't filed my 2012 tax return. Well, that's a problem right there. You know, that's a competency in financial management. But we need financial reporting. But the reason we're looking at that is we're looking at the comparatives of period over period. How has the business performed? Where are the cost bins? We know things change from time to time. But it gives a potential buyer and certainly a lender that's going to lend on the business an idea about the health of the business and where
exactly right
where the risk is.
Yeah, and it also, as a business owner, you have a really good idea what's going on. You know, and you're not running by your seat of your pants. We see people that will lay employees off because they don't realize that their business is seasonal. You know, maybe their cash flow turns down or they lose one customer and you've got to cut three staff members, but last month you went out and bought new furniture because you thought you needed new desks, and had you known what was coming, you wouldn't have bought the new furniture because you knew that you know your cash was going to be in short supply because you had been managing it a little better.
Interesting you say that, because a lot of times someone's owned their business. I had a gentleman that came in today. He's owned his business 24 years and it's in the technology industry. I am going to be the first person in 24 years that's going to be a third party looking at his books besides the accountant, which is strictly doing financial reporting for government entities, doing tax returns or quarterlies. You know, they do their own payroll internal. And I can already tell you, I had a 30-minute meeting with him going to the financials before we met with the buyer, which is my client. I actually represent the buyer in this transaction. And it already uncovered some things that he, having a third party look at it and analyze the numbers, has a value to it. And he didn't have anything written. He does not. He's one of the 95%ers that doesn't have a plan.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. We've looked at 12 insurance businesses to buy over the years. We've done due diligence on 8 and bought 2. Hmm. And you know, people would go, well, man, that's a lot of work. And I'm like, well, once you get into the financials of these companies, you gotta walk away because the guy hasn't set the business up to be sold. You don't understand, and he doesn't understand it as a seller. There's a way to package your business so it's attractive for a buyer. You know that as a broker, there's some things you can do in the 2 or 3 years before you decide to sell it that can make the business very, very attractive to a buyer. And most sellers fail to do that. The moral of the story is the guy didn't want his staff to know he was thinking about selling, so we were actually in the business at night looking at the financials, and he told us that the business basically had about $6 million of sales, and so we go in and we're looking at he doesn't have any financials, but he has producer reports from the insurance companies. They send to validate it. So I find $3 million of production. So I ask him, well, how do you figure that you have $6 million? He said, well, if you take my revenue and divide it by 20%, that equals $6 million, which is, he thought his gross profit was 20%. His commission rate was actually closer to 10%.
Yeah, 8 or 10.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, you show him that. And the other thing he had the business with 40 different insurance companies.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So there was no value there to the business. So we left, and you know, I still don't know if he ever sold the business or what he did with it. But you know, my advice to him when I left was, look, get your business aggregated up, you know, to three main carriers with maybe two or three more insurance companies. You know this from distribution, Robert, when you were in the business, that you know, you got to have a few big players in your warehouse and a few ancillary lines, but you can't have hundreds of lines, otherwise you won't build any scale with anybody.
Yeah, so, and it also comes to, you know, discounts and production. They can cut you because you're not doing your minimums.
Yeah.
So with the planning, what do you recommend for small business owners of how they get started with the planning?
You know, I'm doing a consulting project right now for a group of insurance agents up in Ohio, and the interesting thing is we just gave them a template to deliver their plan. Our consulting firm has, we call it the six pillars of success, and it's built around insurance businesses, but you can apply it to anyone. But these particular group chose infrastructure, human resources, and marketing were the three pillars that they wanted to focus on. So they're building a small plan for us based on that. And the template that I gave them, I stole it from Microsoft Office. If you go into Microsoft Office and type a business plan template, it'll come up. I took their template, changed it for our particular purposes, but basically, hey, what's your end game plan? What's your mission statement? What's your vision statement? Who's the team? Who's going to do this? You know, what are your key problems that you need to address, and how are you going to solve those key problems? And then give me a simple financial analysis of what you want to do. You know, my first business plan when we started was on a piece of paper. Today, it's a strategy document that's hundreds of pages of long, but we're almost $100 million business today, so it's got to be like that. But in the beginning, simple is better.
Yeah, the desk drawer.
Yeah.
Open the desk drawer and see what your plan was at the beginning of the year.
You know, I'll tell you a great story to end this segment. When I was a kid, I didn't know I had done it, but I apparently had written all my goals down when I was in the seventh grade in a class or whatever. My parents moved out of our house in our homestead, or even to call it, and I was already married and gone. My mom brought five boxes of my mementos over from childhood and put it in my garage. My wife told me, hey, you need to clean that stuff up. My garage is some kind of a freak. It's neat and painted floor and all that stuff. And so my son and I, he's probably in the sixth or seventh grade, we're out there looking at it, and he's laughing on the floor because he said, Dad, you got everything you wanted. You had a nice house. You had an AC Cobra, which is a car I had sitting in the garage. You got to have one of a hot girlfriend, I think's what the quote was. I think my wife's hot, but so, and it said I wanted more patience. And he was laughing because I don't have, I didn't get more patience. I got everything else, but more patience.
So, you can't buy that.
The moral of that story is if you write it down, it'll probably happen some way or another.
Yeah, the 75% of it did.
Yes, that's true. Right. That's pretty cool.
Well, any other anecdotal information for the planning?
Well, I really believe you have to remember the 5% rule. And if you can set down your dreams and goals at a personal level, set down your dreams and goals at a business level, you can be very, 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 very successful at achieving them. And what I will tell you that most people miss is you can't let the naysayers stop you. You know, Michael Jordan was cut from his high school basketball team. Wilma Rudolph was told she was paralyzed at one time and she won 3 or 4 or 5 Olympic gold medals. People will tell you can't do this. You've been told all your life, Robert, you can't do this. You can't be a business broker. You can't be a radio host. You can't be this. Ignore those people and do what you want to do.
Very good. We're speaking with Warren Barhorst, CEO and founder of Essential Risk Management, Insurance and Financial Services, and author of Game Plan, the Definitive Playbook for Starting or Growing Your Business. When we return, we're going to discuss risk management.
Comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Business brokerage is a very regional business due to the requirement of having face-to-face buyer and seller meetings. While Robert and Doug are regionally centric to South Central Texas with their brokerage company, Business Brokers of San Antonio, and their equipment appraisal company, Equipment Appraisers of San Antonio, they have also established BizBrokerTalk.com to help assist sellers and buyers with finding professionals in a variety of areas required in the business transaction process. This includes certified business brokers, SBA loan packagers, 401k conversion companies, lenders, as well as other necessary advisory sources. Whether you're selling or buying a business, you need a team of professionals on your side to guide you through the process. Visit BizBrokerTalk.com today. And if you're in the South Texas area, please visit Business Brokers of San Antonio at bbofsa.com or Equipment Appraisers of San Antonio at eaofsa.com.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This is Biz Broker Talk with Robert Howells and Doug Scheiding. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you may send an email to podcast@bizbrokertalk.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Biz Broker Talk with Robert Howells and Doug Scheiding. Doug is on vacation this week, and we're visiting with Warren Barhorse, founder and CEO of Essential Risk Management Insurance and Financial Services. Last segment, we talked about planning. We discussed the 5% rule, and now we're going to talk about risk management. It's a special area for Warren, and let's let you start with how you like to present that in your seminars.
It's just interesting because risk management is also planning, and people get really, really mad at me because everything I do is about planning. You know, my son Spencer always likes to tease me because he says, "Dad, the trouble with your business is you're always trying to convince people to do the right thing. Maybe we need to find something that's not illegal but unethical, and like beer or something like that, so we can sell it without having to try to convince people to do the right thing." But the reality is that, and people don't know the statistics, but 50% of businesses do not reopen after a catastrophe.
That I did not know that.
And what's interesting about that is it's not because they didn't have insurance; it's because they don't have a plan on how to be without revenue for weeks at a time, or how to be with limited revenue because their business had a fire or whatever. So, and they never recover from it. So the planning piece is big. You know, so a lot of times when we're in there talking to them, we're not selling insurance. We're helping them build a plan to how to overcome the future. You know, if something, God forbid, happens to your business. But you know, when a hurricane comes to Houston or to our area, we have a catastrophe plan, and part of that plan is that the servers, which we have about $500,000 of cell phone technology and servers, they end up in a suburban and drive away. People will say, "Well, why do you do that?" Well, that's better than them being ruined. We have to uninstall them. We have a remote place that we in Abilene, Texas, where we set up. It's our backup place that keeps the business running, and then we move that equipment out of harm's way so that if we do get hit, take a direct hit at our business, we can come back up relatively quickly. Because to order a server, we have data recover. We can recover the data onto it. It's going to take weeks to actually make that happen.
Yeah.
And we consider ourselves critical need, just like the fire department and the police department during a crisis like that, because those clients are calling us needing help, you know, and during...
Getting their lives back together.
Yeah. During 2008 Hurricane Ike, we were down. We were never down. We had people calling from other insurance companies asking, say, "Hey, my friend's with you. He talked to you. I can't get a hold of my insurance agent or insurance company. Can you help us?" And we would explain to them how to mitigate damages, what rights they had under their policy, which are usually state regulated type rates. And, "Hey, you can do this. You can stop the damage. You can protect the damage, and your company will reimburse you for those type of things." So we were just giving them basic advice. But the reason we were there is because we had planned for the catastrophe.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So it's a great lesson. And the first thing I would tell you about risk is to understand it. There's really three things going on. And, you know, they're the things that you're informed about, which is what you know, the things you're ill-informed about, which is what you should know, and then the things you're uninformed about, which is the stuff you don't know. And, you know, informed is, you know, Bob, you know, if you... smoke cigarettes, you got a potential to get you got a risk of getting cancer.
That's correct.
You know that pretty cut and dry. So that one's easy for people to see. The ill-informed stuff is I-9 verification. So the federal government after 9/11 came out and said, "You know what? You need to verify who's working in your company, who's there." So there's all these rules and regulations that you check a person's driver's license, you check their ID, and you verify that they're actually a U.S. citizen and can work for you. Well, okay, so people don't follow that rule. Well, then they get an I-9 inspection from the Department of Labor, and then they get fines and all kinds of problems because they were ill-informed.
Correct.
Okay? So that's one of those things you do. And then there's the stuff that you're uninformed about. This one walks both the line of uninformed and ill-informed, but we'll use 1099 independent contractors as a great example. People say, "Oh, he's a contractor." Really, your secretary is a contractor.
Yeah. How's that possible?
It's not possible. The Department of Labor would say that she's a non-exempt hourly employee, and you should be paying her that way.
Correct.
But
supply her own tools, her own hours, correct.
So people are uninformed. They don't know that there's a rule there or anything, so they pay them that way, and then they end up getting in trouble again. And here again, that's not something we sell as an insurance product, but people think when I walk in the room, I'm an insurance person, and I'm not. I'm a risk manager. I'm looking at ways to mitigate those risks, to make them go away, so that that client doesn't have those problems. And what happens with risk itself is there's only four things you can do with it. You can assume the risk. So if you drink and drive, you're assuming the risk to give. You're assuming the risk of getting a DWI or getting a wreck and hurting somebody. You can mitigate it. So in the drinking example, you get a taxi to take you home, and therefore you get drunk. It doesn't hurt anybody, and you've mitigated the potential for that to happen. You can transfer it. In most people's case, they transfer the risk by transferring it to via a financial vehicle of insurance to somebody, to an insurance company or whatever. So your house has a chance of burning down. You transfer that risk to the insurance company for a premium, and they now assume the risk of that. And then the last thing you can do is avoid it. You can just not have a house or not go out to the bar or whatever. You just don't do the activity. And when you're looking at this from a consumer perspective, people need to understand this because they don't really look at it from the proper lens. And you know, when we're looking at it, you know, they just don't get it because they're worried about their car being stolen. And there's about a 1 in 10,000 chance of your car being stolen.
That's amazing.
You lock the doors, but you lock the doors
every time.
Every time when you come in. But, you know, when I was playing sports in high school and college, I loved a hot summer day because we'd get a big thunderstorm and the clouds would start crackling with thunder and the coach would holler, "Go to the house," which meant run to the field house as fast as you possibly can, take a shower and get in your street clothes before the thunderstorm left. Because if you didn't, you'd be back outside practicing again, right? Nobody wants to practice, right? Well, there's a 1 in 10,000 chance that you could be struck by lightning, but we're all afraid of that one also. But the reality is there's a 95 out of 100 chance you won't retire financially independent. There's a 100 out of 100 chance you're going to die.
Yeah.
But people don't even, you know, I'm not trying to sell you life insurance, Bob. What's the plan when you die? How does your business continue? What's the plan? If you die in a car wreck on the way home tonight, what's the plan to transition the business to somebody else? Is there a key employee that's going to take it over? Is something going to happen, or do all this work, all these people just melt away? Because our experience would tell you most of it just melts away because there's no plan.
Sometimes I've seen companies, and when they get set up, they have a buy-sell agreement. And a lot of times that buy-sell agreement, it'll have, you know, if the spousal rights and all that kind of stuff, should somebody – we've seen that. But that's very few companies have those kind of agreements.
They don't.
Partnerships and corporations that are small business, they set it up on the web and that's it. And it wouldn't put a plan together.
You know, you got to go back to my first thing under planning, and you got to begin with the end in mind. You've got to remember what's the end game. The end game is this is going to happen. So I can tell you there's a specific document in this organization. If something happens to me, they know exactly what to do. They know what's going to happen, where it's going to happen. There's life insurance funding that vehicle in our case to make sure there's cash to make those transactions happen.
Is that the key man policy?
It's a key man policy on me. So you could buy a key man person on a producer, or you could buy a cross purchase or buy a sell agreement to buy the stock from partners and different things. That's really the funding vehicle for the plan. But you may have a company may be wealthy enough that it has enough cash to fund the plan. It doesn't need any. To transfer that help to another insurance company or whatever, it may just needs a document in place, or some people have sat down and thought about what they're going to do in case they have that problem. So that's the big piece there, and I tell people that because what they should be focused on is that 1 in 100 businesses break the $1 million in sales mark.
Really,
you know, 98% of them. You know, there's just not very many of them that are over $1 million a year in sales. 50 out of 100 businesses fail in the first 5 years.
That sounds about right from what we've seen, especially in the retail arena.
You know, and the last piece I've already talked about is 5 in 100 businesses have a plan. And so from a risk manager's perspective, it's really about sitting down with somebody you trust and having an honest conversation. And what we see in the insurance business is that they don't trust somebody, and I like to use Rockefeller as my example, but Rockefeller was the richest man in the world, and people would say, well, he was a genius, but Rockefeller gave 85% of his wealth to the federal government, and the reason that happened to him, he did a lot of great things for society. The reason that happened was because he became unapproachable. We thought he was so good at generating wealth and money that he obviously would have a plan in case something happened to him.
Right.
So the people around him stopped telling him what he needs to hear and tell him
what he wants to hear.
Right. And as a business owner, you got to have somebody on your team, a risk manager in my perspective, that will tell you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear. You're the business owner. You make the decision. But my job is to make you aware of what your exposures are, tell you your options for limiting them, mitigating them, transferring them, avoiding them, or whatever. And then you make the decision as the owner what you're going to do. And you're as an owner, you can get mad at me and say, Warren, I wish you would stop telling me this or whatever. And I'm going to say, dude, I told you when I started our relationship, this is my role. I don't care what you do. I do, because I usually like my customers and make my stuff. But the reality is that's not my job. My job is to tell you what you need to hear. Then you make the decisions as a business owner.
So most business owners, small business owners, you think are isolated and do not have a mentor there. And this is kind of what we talked about last segment is I have a lot, probably a majority of the owners that come in to our office wanting to sell, they don't have a plan. They don't have an exit strategy. They're either sick of their customers or sick of their business or sick of, you know, regulations that come and they want to sell. And where it's one of the, you know, dismal D's, death, divorce, disease, whatever, it goes down that list.
I like that,
the dismal D's. And you really can't do anything. I can't tell you how many emergency situations come in. We like to talk to somebody 1 to 3 years before they're going to sell to put a plan together for selling their business. If nothing else, just the financial reporting.
Yeah,
that's the biggest issue.
And what I would tell you is that if they had been working on their plan the whole time, you could come to me. If the dismal D's pop up, they could sell the business because they've already got it set up. It's ready right now to sell. It's ready right now to transition to the other person because they've been working on a plan to do that. It'll also be a much more successful business, and they'll also get a much higher multiple when they sell it.
That is correct.
They'll make a lot more money by doing that little bit of planning. And it's not difficult. It's just having some candid, vulnerable conversations with somebody you trust to make you see, and then you start walking towards that goal of fixing things on a daily basis. And you know, the last page of our risk management presentation, there's a picture of an elephant, and it says, how do you eat an elephant? And
one bite at a time.
Yeah. You know, it's overwhelming when you look at the whole picture, but let's just talk about what happens here. Let's do this piece, and let's talk about what happens here. And slowly but surely, you'll get the components put in place, and over a 12-month, 18-month period, you can have your business situated or in a situation where it can be very, very profitable if you pass away or if you want to sell it or whatever you want to do.
Right. I mean, it's the too often an owner comes in and the heir apparent became very unapparent suddenly. They thought the child or the key employee was going to take over the business, and the child moved several states away and the key employee went off and started their own business or went somewhere else because things didn't move quickly enough for them. There was no surety that they were going to move to the next level. And so I can see where the value of having a plan, but a written plan, I gotta agree with you. I very rarely see a written business plan that's ever updated, has any kind of an exit strategy.
Yeah, and it's a pretty simple process, and people just forget about it. So you know, I talk about that 5% rule, and you know, it ended up the same thing applies to risk management. You know, what's your plan to mitigate these exposures? And you know, if you're looking for somebody to get help on that, you know, I always tell people, you know, what to look for an advisor, whether it's a business broker like yourself, Robert, or whether it's an attorney or a CPA or whatever. You know, there's some critical key components, and the first one is you must like and trust the person. If you don't get a warm, fuzzy feeling about them, pick a different one.
Yeah.
There's hundreds of business brokers in the marketplace. There's hundreds of insurance advisors, hundreds of attorneys. And, you know, the next thing is they've got to be giving you advice, not selling you something.
Right.
And I know your style. You're very direct. You tell them what they need. That's the kind of work you do is you give people advice. It's the same. You know me. I'm very direct. This is the way it is. You'll pick your folder up and go home before you'll compromise your integrity to do a deal with somebody. And that's the kind of person you should be looking for if you're trying to sell your business or do any kind of planning for your business. They got to know your situation, and they can't know your situation unless you're willing to have candid, vulnerable conversations. And I like to use this story about my parents, and they'll probably listen to this radio show and kill me for it, but my parents are in their mid-80s, and they have this health denial, as I like to call it. And my father fell off our roof in the 1970s and landed on his shoulder and head and actually had a grand mal seizure and had epilepsy, was diagnosed with epilepsy from that point forward. And he lived his whole adult life, worked, and was productive, taking medication to keep his seizures from coming. Well, as he got older, he kept having these breakthrough seizures. And there's two physicians in my family, my oldest brother and my second oldest sister are both doctors, and they kept saying, "Dad, what you're describing to us is not does not sound like an electrical problem. It sounds like a heart problem. You need to go to a cardiologist and tell him what's going on." So he does that, and the cardiologist actually implants a little recording device in his heart and gives him this little outside device to record it if he has one of those episodes to see if it's his heart or if it's actually his brain that's causing the seizure. Well, he's actually at my brother's office, sitting at his desk. He still works a couple days a week at my brother's office. My dad was a maintenance engineer for Honeywell for years and years and years, so my brother has a surgery center and some other things, so he makes sure the air conditioning works.
Important things.
And he loves doing that. Well, he basically dies sitting in a chair at his desk. You know, they hear him hit the floor. My brother runs. They get him. My brother resuscitates him. They transport him to the hospital, and my brother's like, "Dad, where's your recorder so we can see what your heart did?" He said, "Mom's got it at home." So by the time my mom gets in the car and drives to the hospital, the technician says, "It's been too long to record this event, but you were dead for 29 seconds on October 2nd.
Oh, my goodness.
So he had a spell at the house. My mother recorded it. She just sat with him in this. She told us, "I just sat with him and held him, and he woke back up like he always does."
Oh, good. And so he didn't think anything about it, no. Tell anybody or do anything about it.
Right. So he didn't tell his doctor because people do this. They won't have a candid, vulnerable conversation because you don't want to know, right? Well, in business, you got to have candid, vulnerable conversations with your tax advisor, with your attorney, with your risk manager, with your business broker. You got to have a candid conversation. And what we, you know, well, basically they put a pacemaker in my father's heart, and they've got his medication for his epilepsy down to the lowest levels it's ever been.
Because it really wasn't so much the epilepsy, it was this fire the heart.
Yeah.
Oh, good gracious.
But we see the same thing in businesses because they won't really share. They'll only tell you half the information. You know about this in your work. They only give you half the details.
Oh, we never know that until 2 weeks after closing. You never know all the details.
Yeah. So, and the last thing I'll tell you on this one is you got to pick knowledge over experience. Just because they're old and gray doesn't mean they're smart, and just because they're young and have an MBA from Harvard doesn't mean they're smart. You got to pick the guys that have knowledge over experience or pedigree is what I tell you. And the last thing is back to my parents' analogy: prescription without diagnosis is malpractice. So if I give you advice without knowing the true story, it's going to be wrong.
Very true. And I guess there's something to be said is there's a reason that large corporations, publicly traded corporations, have outside consultants that come in, is you need to have a third-party, arm's-length look at the operations of the business. And,
yeah.
And I have to say, majority of businesses do not have a board of directors for that kind of advice. We've been visiting with Warren Barhorst, author of Game Plan, the Definitive Playbook for Starting or Growing Your Business, and founder and CEO of a business known as Essential. It's a risk management, insurance, and financial services company. When we come back, we're going to discuss wealth planning.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Business brokerage is a very regional business due to the requirement of having face-to-face buyer and seller meetings. While Robert and Doug are regionally centric to South Central Texas with their brokerage company, Business Brokers of San Antonio, and their equipment appraisal company, Equipment Appraisers of San Antonio, they have also established BizBrokerTalk.com to help assist sellers and buyers with finding professionals in a variety of areas required in the business transaction process. This includes certified business brokers, SBA loan packagers, 401k conversion companies, lenders, as well as other necessary advisory sources. Whether you're selling or buying a business, you need a team of professionals on your side to guide you through the process. Visit BizBrokerTalk.com today. And if you're in the South Texas area, please visit Business Brokers of San Antonio at BBofSA.com or Equipment Appraisers of San Antonio at EAofSA.com.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
This is Biz Broker Talk with Robert Howells and Doug Scheiding. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you may send an email to podcast@bizbrokertalk.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Biz Broker Talk with Robert Howells and Doug Scheiding. Doug is on vacation this week. We're visiting with Warren Barhorse, founder and owner, CEO of Essential, a risk management insurance and financial services company. He has written a book several years ago called Game Plan, Definitive Playbook for Starting or Growing Your Business. For the next two emails that we receive in to podcast@bizbrokertalk, we will be handing those books out. Again, that's bizbrokertalk.net. Thank you. So we've been talking about a plan, about having to put a plan together, a catastrophe plan, I should say. Second section, we talked about risk management, and now we're going to talk about wealth planning. And there seems to be an ongoing theme here of planning.
There is an ongoing theme of of planning, and you know, I just think that people have missed this. They miss this early in their life, so that they don't do it. And I always use the analogy, would you drive to Montana without a map? And the answer is no. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about already, but if you want to maximize your multiple when you sell your business, what I call maximizing EBITDA, mm-hmm. You know, you have to do some planning ahead of time. And you talk about, you know, if I can get to somebody a year, two, 3 years before they want to sell it, I can tell them the things they need to do to get their business prepared to sell. And most of that's around planning and reporting and all those pieces. And, you know, in the insurance business, we see agencies go for anywhere from as low as 75% of their last 12 months earnings to 2 to 3 times their gross earnings, which, you know,
that's very high. You very rarely have a biz go more than one times revenue.
And so but the ones that have done that are really, they're very, very profitable businesses that have a consistent program for producing that profit. We also see them go for 8-9 times EBITDA.
Oh my God.
So there's two ways you can set them up. So if maybe your expenses are higher because of your income and the things you do inside your business, so your EBITDA doesn't look so good, then you're going to push it to be a multiple of gross sales. But if you have managed out all those expenses because it's a larger business or whatever, then you could find a buyer that might pay you 7 to 8 times, 8-9 times the EBITDA.
We have a saying, business brokerage: owners maximize their lifestyle by minimizing their taxes. But when you go to sell a business, you got to stop playing those games.
Yeah. Which most of the planning, wealth planning that we teach our customers is around using those tools that the government allows us to use to maximize the wealth that you get out of your business. And you're exactly right. You have to turn those tools down in the years before you want to sell it, or you have to document the tools you're using so that the buyer can see that, okay, this guy's he's put $50,000 in his 401k plan. He's put $50,000 in his 401k plan for his wife. He's made a profit sharing contribution to his employees that's, you know, 6% of their salary. So he can see where the money's going. It's a true trail. So you can backload that back into the EBITDA and say, okay, that money's really there. It was just put in these buckets to reduce taxation.
Right.
Whatever.
And we say that how we characterize that is those are called add backs. You're adding that back to the bottom line.
Yeah.
And it's got to be verifiable and supportable.
Yeah.
And that's why if you own a cash business, and there's the story that I might have told before, but it's a guy that owned a donut shop. He had two cash registers, and the buyer didn't believe it wasn't a business we'd list, but it was a business that another broker had. And this owner kept saying about how much money he made, and his financials didn't show it. And he said, told the buyer, he said, come out on Saturday morning and come to my donut shop and I'll show you. And the guy came out there and he had two cash registers. He had one for checks and credit cards. He had another one for cash.
Yeah.
And the problem is you take it once, you're not going to get it again.
Yep.
You got to report it.
Yep. That's exactly right. So if you don't report it, you're not going to get it when you sell the business at the other side.
And so simple math is,
yeah,
a nominal tax rate is what, 28%, would you say? So 28%, if I take $1,000 cash and I don't deposit it, I have no record of it, not being reported to the IRS, I save myself 28%. But if my business sells for a 3x multiple, that $28 that you, or $280 you save, that $1,000 you didn't report, would have been $3,000 at closing. It's really bad math.
Yeah, it is bad math. People understand that. And there's also, the government's giving you some tools to take legitimate tax deductions to offset that income anyways. He could have had a 401k plan, or he could have a SEP, a supply employee pension plan. He could do anything depending on the size of the business. We can do those, use those tools very, very regularly, and the government will allow you to put, it's roughly $50,000 for 2014 in that plan without any taxation.
That's a significant amount of money. So that compounds on interest. It's huge.
Yeah, but you're reducing your earnings to that the government you report taxation on.
It's pre-tax.
By $50,000. Okay, so that we can do that. We can defer compensation. There's all kinds of programs, but our simple program that we typically tell people to do is to put a 401k plan in place, which a 401k plan is called a defined contribution plan. Basically, you're defining how much money you put into the program. Then you layer what we call a profit sharing program on top of that. That's when it's discretionary. The company has a good year. You want to make a profit sharing contribution. Okay, we make a profit sharing contribution, and it's distributed across the employees of the company. In most cases, the owners of a business will make a profit sharing contribution, and 60% of the dollars they put in ends up in the owner's pocket.
Did not know that.
Yeah, so it's a very lucrative. You know, the government set it up so that share some of the wealth with your employees. We'll let you keep a lot of the wealth yourself. Now that there's some mathematics that go into that, and ages and age ranges inside of a business could skew that, and maybe a profit sharing program isn't the best tool, but it's one of the ones. It's one of the tools that are in the toolbox you can look at. The next thing we can layer in there is called a cash balance plan. Instead of being a defined contribution, cash balance is like an old pension plan. It's defined benefit, so you actually could put hundreds of thousands of dollars in your program to set aside for this $5,000 a month retirement benefit you're setting up for your employees. Works great for small firms with not a lot of employees and those things that have good cash flow and are trying to look for ways to legally defer their taxes to a later date and time.
So it's not an expensive program to administer?
No, it's not. Yeah. So none of those programs are. You can get a third-party administrator in any metropolitan area that can administer that for you and do the actuarial analysis on it and the testing to make it pass the government's rules and regulations, so you have a legal compliant plan to do it.
Very good.
So people just don't know that those tools are there. And if you ask your CPA, what your CPA will say is they don't work. And we chuckle at that. And I love CPAs because I have a great one for my business. But CPAs, they know the tax code for the business. They can't be retirement or an investment advisor also.
Or business valuator. Some of the worst valuations we've ever seen have come from the owner's CPA.
Right. Their job is to be a certified public accountant, and most of them, their role is to file tax returns and understand the tax code. The tax code is, you know, it's probably millions of pages long. They have to understand all that, and how can they be a 401k plan or a cash balance plan program? I'm not even a specialist at that. I bring somebody into the meeting. I recognize that a client has a need for that. I go get a third-party administrator that knows that business and bring him into the meeting and say, my client's got this problem. Can you help him?
Well, that makes sense. It's not a good assignment for you, so you find it. Someone has the expertise.
Just like I would bring you into it. If I had a client that wanted to sell, I'd say, I got a buddy that's in the business. He's great at doing it. I don't know how to evaluate. You know, I could evaluate your business, but I can't tell you that's what it would sell for or be right. You know, let's go talk to Robert. He has experience in that space.
So the maximizing of EBIT, I think we're both on the same page from a brokerage and a risk standpoint and trying to plan. So we've covered some of the tools that you have from the IRS, and I think there's a couple others that as well.
Yeah, the last one that we typically layer in, it would be called captive insurance. And captive insurance would be owning your own insurance operation. Not so you want to sell insurance policies to the outside public. It's so that you could do what we call enterprise risk management. And there's lots of people out in the space doing this wrong. And there's lots of ways to do it right, where the IRS is, it's a completely legal way to manage risk in your business and also help you control and help you with some of your wealth planning. And, you know, so how a captive insurance company works is there's basically three types. There's group captives, general purpose captives, and 831B captives. Group captives are typically used for companies that have, maybe they've got a workers' compensation problem, or a general liability insurance problem. It's very, very expensive because they're in a high-risk business. So they pool together with some other people that have similar businesses, and they start their own insurance company to provide workers' comp to their employees. That would be called a group captive. General purpose captive, you guys have all experienced this. When you go to a retail store and you buy a clock radio or a tape player or a CD player or whatever, and you buy and they offer you a warranty,
yeah,
that's going into their group captive. So that's their own insurance company that they've set up to provide that warranty service to their customers. And then the last one is what we call 831B. 831B is the line in the IRS code where it's at. It's for small insurance companies that do less than $1.2 million a year in sales. And how they work is basically you can set up programs to insure exposures in your business. And pretty much you can insure anything you want in the marketplace. So, if you were a pro football player and you said, hey, I want to insure my arm because I'm a great quarterback, we could go to Lloyd's of London, which is an insurance exchange. We could take it to the syndicate, ask them, would somebody insure Bob Howell's arm, and how much would you do it for, and we could get somebody to take that risk. Okay, but in a small business environment, I have exposures. I have enterprise risk exposures, regulatory issues. Maybe I'm a contractor, and I've got to bid jobs, and the cement cost in my job, I'm bidding them today, but I may not do this work for 18 months when the job's finally let. I want it, but I want it on a bid based in 2014, but I got to buy materials in 2016.
Yeah.
You could buy a material, you could buy an insurance policy. You could fund it yourself inside your own internal 831B to cover that material increase.
If there's inflation on the cost of for all goods.
Yeah, so there's all kinds of risk a business owner has that he can't buy commercially available insurance. So you can layer that captive insurance program on top of your other risk management program that you're buying from commercially available carriers, and maybe you take a higher deductible instead of having a $500 deductible. Maybe you take a $100,000 deductible, and you set that inside that $100,000 corridor inside your own captive. And by doing that, you can move those dollars into the captive. You get to take a tax deduction out of your operating company and put it into your captive. The cool thing about captives is the premium paid in is forever tax forgiven. You know, people go, oh, that's a great tax game. No, if you take the money out of the captive, you have to pay tax on it. So the IRS lets you use this tool to hedge, or, you know, to set up a sinking fund or hedge risk going forward and not pay tax on it for that period. But if you take the money out of the captive insurance company or use it, it's taxable
at that point.
Yeah, there's no gain. The IRS is letting you do it because they're letting you plan. It's in the tax code to let you plan for the future. Not to defraud the government out of the tax dollars that you owe them.
Okay, so it's a tax deferment and to put those funds in there. So how big of a company do you think you need to be revenue or cash flow wise to do something like that?
You know, you have to have a relatively cash profitable business. It takes a little bit of money to capitalize them. You need to probably, depending on the regulator, which state or where you put the captive at, you're going to need $200,000 just to capitalize the company, and then you're probably going to have to spend $300,000 to $400,000 a year in premium just to justify the expense of owning and operating the captive insurance company.
So you're going to have to inject that much money.
Yeah.
And is there a limit on how much you can inject?
$1.2 million a year of premium. Otherwise, you jump out of that 831B status, and you jump into general purpose captive status, which the rules
change.
Rules and regulation change. So, and it's important to note that it's not a tax play. You made mention of that there's a tax deferral or whatever. It's not. It's a risk management opportunity to set aside money for the future when you have an exposure that's you can't control or buy commercially available insurance for.
Very good. So talk about a little bit about your client and your marketplace for your services. What do you see out there?
Our business, we focus on, from a personal lines perspective, what we call mass affluent and private clients. So people that live, you know, in the mass affluent space, we call that someone lives in a $250,000 house to $1 million home. And then people, our private client book is $1 million homes to the very wealthy. And then we deal with small and medium-sized business owners that they could have two employees to, you know, our largest customer has 400 employees.
Right.
So we have specialties in all that space. We write stuff on Main Street. We write stuff a block and a half off of Main, or half a block off of Main Street, light manufacturing, distribution, and we'll do some stuff a block, you know, two blocks off of Main Street that might be some clean manufacturing type stuff. But if it's greasy or dirty from a manufacturing perspective, we probably don't have the specialty inside our shop to manage those people's risks.
Right.
If it's a lube center or auto service business, we're very, very good in that space because it falls off that block and a half off of Main Street. Yeah. So it's a simple way to look at it.
Can you share with us what your next book is going to be about?
Yeah, it's actually about what I call selling in the connection culture. It's called a game plan.
It's about planning?
It's not about planning. It's about what I believe Facebook and Twitter and all those things are telling us. I believe we're all tribal in nature because of where we came from, and that if you can figure out how to connect with people and actually have a one-on-one real connection with them, you can do very well in the world we're moving into, even though it seems to be so impersonal. It really is a connection type culture.
Very good. We've been visiting with Warren Barhorst, founder and CEO of Essential Risk Management Insurance and Financial Services Company. And for the next email we have at bizbroker.com, we have a book, Game Plan, The Definitive Playbook for Starting or Growing Your Business. Next week, Doug Schein will be back, and we look forward to visiting with you then.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
Thank you again for joining us today for Biz Broker Talk. Please join Robert and Doug again next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. After today's show, we hope you are one step closer to a successful sale of your business.